Until about 1934, Oppenheimer displayed little interest in current events or politics. He was not so much ignorant as he was indifferent, and he certainly was not politically active. But later, at a time when he wished to highlight his political naivete, he cultivated the myth that he was oblivious to politics and practical affairs. He claimed that he owned neither a radio nor a telephone, and that he never read a newspaper or magazine. And he'd like to tell the story that he first heard about the stock market crash of October 29, 1929, months after the event. He said he never cast a vote until the 1936 presidential election. "To many of my friends," he testified in 1954, "my indifference to contemporary affairs seemed bizarre, and they often chided me for being too much of a highbrow. I was interested in man and his experience. I was deeply interested in my science, but I had no understanding of the relations of man to his society." Years later, Robert Serber observed that this self-portrait of Oppenheimer as an unworldly, withdrawn, unaesthetic person who didn't know what was going on, all this was exactly the opposite of what he was really like. At Berkeley, Oppenheimer surrounded himself with friends and colleagues who took an intense interest in political and social issues. From the autumn of 1931, his landlady at 2665 Shasta Road was Mary Ellen Washburn, a tall, commanding woman who wore colorful, full-length batik dresses and loved to socialize. Her husband, John Washburn, was an accountant who may also have taught economics at the university. Their home was a long-standing social hub for Berkeley's intellectuals, and, like Mary Ellen herself, many of these people had strong sympathies with the political left. The FBI would later conclude that Mary Ellen was an active member of the Communist Party in Alameda County. A young professor of French literature named Hocken Chevalier had been attending parties hosted by the Washburns since the 1920s. The Serbers came to these parties, as did a beautiful young medical student named Jean Tatlock. It was only natural that Oppie, a bachelor living downstairs, dropped by for these social occasions. He was always gracious and usually charmed everyone. But one evening, while he was discoursing at length about a particular poem, the guests heard John Washburn, by now deep in his cups, mutter, "Never since the Greek tragedies has there been heard the unrelieved pomposity of a Robert Oppenheimer." "We were not political at all in any overt way," recalled Melba Phillips. Oppie once remarked to Leo Nadelsky, "I know three people who are interested in politics. Tell me, what has politics to do with truth, goodness, and beauty?" But after January 1933, when Adolf Hitler came to power in Germany, politics began to intrude into Oppenheimer's life. By April of that year, German Jewish professors were being summarily dismissed from their jobs. A year later, in the spring of 1934, Oppenheimer received a circular letter soliciting funds to support German physicists as they attempted to emigrate from Nazi Germany. He immediately agreed to earmark for this purpose 3% of his salary, about $100 a year, for 2 years. Ironically, one of the refugees who may have been assisted by this fund was Robert's former professor in Göttingen, Dr. James Franck. When Hitler first came to power, Franck, who had won 2 Iron Crosses during World War I, was one of the few Jewish physicists permitted to keep his post. But a year later, he was forced into exile when he refused to dismiss other Jews from their jobs. By 1935, he was teaching physics at Johns Hopkins University in Baltimore. Similarly, Max Born was forced to flee Göttingen in 1933 and ended up teaching in England. The news from Germany was certainly grim. But by 1934, it would have been difficult for anyone to ignore the political turmoil right in Berkeley's backyard. Almost 5 years of depression had impoverished millions of ordinary citizens. Early that year, labor strife turned violent. In late January, 3,000 lettuce pickers in the Imperial Valley went on strike. Acting on behalf of employers, police arrested hundreds of workers. The strike was quickly broken, and wages fell from 20 cents to 15 cents an hour. Then, on May 9, 1934, more than 12,000 longshoremen set up picket lines at ports up and down the West Coast. By the end of June, the dock strike had virtually strangled the economies of California, Oregon, and Washington. Early in July, authorities attempted to open the port of San Francisco. Police lobbed tear gas bombs at thousands of longshoremen, and a riot ensued. After 4 days of running skirmishes, several policemen fired into a crowd. 3 men were wounded, and 2 of them died. July 5th, 1934, became known as Bloody Thursday. That same day, the Republican governor ordered the California National Guard to seize control of the streets. 11 days later, on July 16th, San Francisco labor unions called a general strike. For 4 days, the city was paralyzed. Federal mediators at last stepped in, and by July 30th, the largest strike in the history of the West Coast ended. The longshoremen returned to work having achieved almost none of their wage demands, but it was clear to all that the unions had achieved a major political victory. The strike had garnered popular sympathy for the longshoremen's plight and greatly strengthened the union movement. On August 28, 1934, in a sign that the political atmosphere had shifted significantly to the left, the radical writer Upton Sinclair stunned the California establishment by decisively winning the Democratic gubernatorial nomination. Although Sinclair lost the general election, partly as a result of intense slander and fear-mongering on the part of the Republicans, California politics would never be the same. Such dramatic events could not go unnoticed by Oppenheimer or his students. Berkeley itself was split between critics and supporters of the strike. When the longshoremen initially walked out on May 9, 1934, a conservative member of the physics faculty, Leonard Loeb, recruited Cal, University of California, Berkeley, football players to act as strikebreakers. Significantly, Oppenheimer later invited some of his students, including Melba Phillips and Bob Serber, to come along with him to a longshoremen's rally in a large San Francisco auditorium. "We were sitting up high in a balcony," recalled Serber, "and by the end we were caught up in the enthusiasm of the strikers shouting with them, 'Strike! Strike! Strike!'" Afterwards, Oppie went to the apartment of a friend, Estelle Kane, where he was introduced to Harry Bridges, the charismatic longshoreman union leader.